Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we return to the archives and continue reading from the October 2016 issue of Guideposts with articles like the cover story, Hiding in Plain Sight. Hiding in Plain Sight. For years, the co-anchor of ABC's 2020 suffered secretly, until that secret nearly killed her. By Elizabeth Vargas, New York, New York. I can feel it coming like a wave. My heart beats faster, my head pounds, my stomach churns, fear surges through me. It can happen in the middle of a busy day at work at the ABC television news magazine 2020 or at home with the boys. There was a time not so long ago that I would have reached for the bottle of wine in the fridge or the bottle I'd hidden underneath the bathroom sink. Now I've found something that works much better, something that helps me live, not die, the powerful weapon of daily prayer. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I was definitely born anxious. Alcoholism came later in life, after years of drinking on the sly. But the anxiety, it was there from the start, as if it was part of the essence of me. I grew up in a very Catholic home. My dad was in the army, and our family's involvement in church was our spiritual constant as we moved from base to base. In the late 60s, we moved to Okinawa. My dad was sent to Vietnam, to Saigon, leaving my mom and my younger brother Chris and me in Japan. My mom was pregnant with my little sister, and in order to stay on the island, she had to work every day, leaving us with a babysitter. Each morning, I would panic. I would chase after her, crying, begging her not to go, grabbing at her skirt, digging in my heels, holding her legs until she peeled away my fingers. On the night Mom gave birth to my sister, I looked out the window from my bunk bed and saw her walking to the car, clutching her stomach with one hand, carrying a bag with the other. I knew she needed to go to the hospital, but I could not contain my panic. I jumped out of bed and ran to the door. I was stopped by a neighbor who had come over to look after us. "What's the matter with you?" she said. "Go back to bed. Stop making a scene." I was only six, but the message sank in, imprinted on me. My anxiety, my panic was something shameful, something to be hidden at all costs, and the cost would prove huge. I white-knuckled my way through anxiety during childhood and adolescence. My dad's army postings meant homes on 9 different bases. I went to 8 different schools. I wasn't wise enough to turn to prayer to deal with stress and panic. I learned to survive the attacks in secret, to bury my feelings. I thrived academically, graduating from the University of Missouri's top-ranked journalism school and starting a career in TV broadcasting. I prided myself on being cool in a crunch, a real professional. My secret was safe, except once. It was a Saturday night in Chicago in the early 90s. I was working at WBBM, doing the 10 o'clock newscast with a veteran co-anchor. All at once, I felt like I couldn't breathe. My hands trembled. I was queasy. I was sure I was going to vomit. I clenched my jaw and stopped reading the teleprompter right in the middle of a story. The air went dead. Hundreds of thousands of viewers could see the real me exposed, a full-blown panic attack on the air. So much for being a cool professional. My co-anchor jumped in and read my part. We went to commercial and he glared at me, furious, and then, like that neighbor all those years ago in Okinawa, demanded to know what was wrong with me. I had no answer, at least not one I was willing to share. I'd violated one of my basic rules, don't make a scene. I vowed it would never happen again. I was careful never to do a broadcast on a full stomach. I discovered that a beta blocker could help. Better yet, off air, when I needed to unwind, a glass of wine hit the spot. It was like turning off the worry switch. Just wine was my rule, though. Nothing stronger. I put a lot of pressure on myself. Good enough wasn't good enough. Everything I did had to be perfect. The more successful I became, it seemed, the more I had to hide. And the more I hid, the more I cut myself off from other people and from God. When I prayed, it was reactive, pleading to get through a stressful day or through a panic attack without anyone knowing. Not a true relationship with God. Then came the job at 2020. It was a huge break, and there was a price. Besides the long hours, I'd have to do a ton of traveling, more hours on a plane, trapped in a tube at 30,000 feet. Reason enough for anxiety. After suffering a particularly harrowing panic attack on one flight, sweating, hyperventilating, I went to a doctor and for the first time confessed my anxiety. He gave me a prescription for anti-anxiety medication. It helped. So did the wine the helpful flight attendants brought to my seat. But you can't hide from everyone, especially someone you love and trust. I met Mark after I moved to New York, and soon we were married. We had two beautiful boys. Mark was the only one I had confided the secret of my anxiety attacks to. He countered with the truth I wasn't ready to believe. "I think you drink too much," he said. "Are you kidding?" I was furious. No one had ever said that to me before. No one knew how much I drank. How dare he? I walked right out of the room. Me, a drunk? I was an Emmy-winning broadcaster on network TV, meeting deadlines left and right, appearing on air night after night. I could cut back or quit anytime I wanted. No problem. What alcoholic could do that? Since Mark didn't like to see me drinking, I would sometimes stop in a little bar on my way home from work and have a glass or two of wine there, draining the day's tension. But that didn't quite feel as nice. I felt pathetic sitting there alone. Sometimes I would pretend I was waiting for a friend. "That's all right," I would say into my dead cell phone. "I just sat down. Take your time." Things got out of control so slowly that I convinced myself there was no problem. I'd go on a trip for work, drink heavily at night after the shoot, then pull it together in time to be on camera in the morning. I told myself I was good at maintaining the work-life balance. But then on a long-anticipated family vacation, I ended up spending most of the time in bed, sleeping off my hangovers from raiding the minibar. The shame was incredible, palpable. Almost as bad as a panic attack. It was like a moral panic attack. I checked into a rehab facility right away, but only for a couple of weeks. Doing the full 28-day program would have meant revealing to my bosses at the network that I had a problem, so I told them I needed surgery. Nothing life-threatening. It was a flat-out lie. The rehab place was beautiful, and the people were kind. They helped me reconnect with God for the first time in years. Not that I was ready to turn my will and my life over to a higher power. That wasn't happening. 2 months later, I was drinking again. I went back to rehab for a longer stint, the full 28-day program. There was so much I had to deal with, especially my feelings. I'd spent the majority of my life hiding. Recovery meant getting honest, most of all with myself. I had to dig deep. I had to confront why I'd become so dependent on alcohol. People all around me spoke openly about themselves. I had to be open too. It was hard, maybe the hardest thing I ever did. One day, close to the end of my stay, I spoke to the group. "I'm really scared," I said. "I'm afraid of going back to my life, of being surrounded by stress and temptation. I'm afraid of my anxiety and what I will do to escape it." Tears came to my eyes. I rarely allowed myself to cry in front of anybody. I thought people would be embarrassed seeing me cry. I expected to be reprimanded the way I had been by that neighbor all those years ago. Instead, my tears were met with understanding and compassion. Was it possible that I could reveal the worst about myself and still be loved? "God bless you," someone said. "Pray to God to help you." Prayer was the tool I could take with me. Prayer, whenever the stress hit, prayer when the desire to reach for a glass of wine overcame me. This time I managed to hold it together back in New York City, for a while at least. I was so glad to be sober, so glad to be back at work. But the stresses were still there, and when I dropped into a recovery meeting with other alcoholics, as I promised I would sit in the back, hiding under a hat, never speaking out, never revealing that I was struggling like everybody else in the room. Gradually, I stopped going to meetings, stopped reaching out to friends in the program. Then came the first setback. I couldn't handle it sober. I thought the anxiety was going to kill me. I didn't pray. I walked into a bar and ordered a drink. It wasn't so much the glass of wine that was my downfall, but that I was no longer praying daily or talking with other people in recovery. My isolation was growing again. Soon I was sneaking wine regularly, and I suppose it was inevitable that I would show up for work drunk, which I did. I hit absolute bottom. Back in Chicago, I'd fallen apart on the air. This was worse, much worse. Yes, the cure turned out to be worse than the disease. There was no hiding it. Now everyone knew I was going into rehab again. I had to issue a public statement. Like so many people, I am dealing with addiction. My shameful secret was there for all to see. I am in treatment. This rehab place was much tougher than the other one. It was grim, and I felt hopeless there. Reaching out to my parents and my brother and sister was what saved me. There was a weekend when family members came. Family histories and family secrets were revealed and explored in a therapeutic session. Setting. My brother Chris, my sister Amy, and I, and both of our parents, made the trip. For the first time ever, we talked about our childhood. Mom and Dad discussed the trials of raising us kids when Dad was in Vietnam and Mom was all on her own in Japan. They knew how hard it was on us kids. My mother had agonized over my daily panic attacks when she left me in the morning. She admitted she didn't comfort me. She didn't know how. The U.S. military was not helping Vietnam vets with their PTSD then. There certainly was no one to help their families with such issues. I wished I could help you, my mom said. I felt so helpless. I didn't know what to do. She put her hand on mine. I'm so sorry. Those words meant everything. They validated my feelings. An enormous weight lifted from me. A burden I'd been carrying for 40-some years. It was all right to be afraid and to talk about it, to God and to other people. Anxiety wasn't going to kill me, but isolation would. I discovered that prayer is my most powerful weapon, not just at the moments of high anxiety, moments when I feel on the verge of losing control, but all the time, turning to God for reassurance and strength as I move through my day. I have a real relationship with Him now, an awareness that it's not just me on my own, that there's a higher power at work in my life, every moment, every day. I end each day by making a list of all the things that I'm thankful for. Gratitude is a potent antidote to fear. I am grateful to my family, grateful for my job, and especially grateful to all those people who have supported me and loved me when I doubted I deserved love. I don't hide in the back of recovery meetings anymore, but sit in the front, glad to help as I have been helped. Anxiety is always there, but prayer is too. It has given me the power to say no to drinking and the power to say yes to life. For more on this story, see Family Room. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you've missed any part of this program, you can access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Building Stronger Families, The Goodness of Her Heart. Would My Mother-in-Law Ever Learn to Knock? By Mary D'Amore, Meadow Vista, California. 7 o'clock Monday morning, my husband Derek and I were in the kitchen with our four kids, grabbing breakfast before we left for work and school. With no warning whatsoever, our back door flew open. No phone call or text to see if we were up. No knock. Nothing. Slippered feet padded across the floor. It could only be one person. My mother-in-law, Nadja. She'd been living in an apartment attached to our house for the last 15 years. How many times had I asked her to knock? Good morning, she said, breezing into the kitchen holding a silver tray piled with freshly baked muffins. I did your laundry while these were in the oven. Now what else can I make you all for breakfast? The kids looked at me for what to say to Oma, as they called her. We had this conversation with her many times. Our two oldest children, both in high school, were born with a rare disorder, arthrogyopathy multiple congenita, which decreased the flexibility of the joints in their arms and shoulders. They had years of physical therapy to help them master basic skills and gain strength in their upper body. Remember, they need to learn to do things for themselves, I said to Nadja, even cooking. Oh, I don't mind, she said. But I do, I thought, my stomach tightening. It's my house. Yes, Nadja meant well. Yes, most people would be grateful to have such a mother-in-law. But would she ever respect or even understand our boundaries? Did she think I wasn't up to doing the laundry and the cooking myself, that I couldn't take care of my own family? Maybe it bothered me so much because, like so many women, I wanted to be that mom who did it all. Juggling my job at the local high school with raising four kids and driving them to all of their activities, while keeping the house perfectly clean and organized. Super mom. I felt guilty bristling at Nadja. She had been nothing but warm and welcoming since Derek and I first started dating. The day he introduced me to his parents, Nadja pulled me into her arms and squeezed me tight as if I were already part of the family. After we married, Derek and I grew even closer to his parents. We'd meet them for dinner out or go to their house to play cards. Then suddenly, my father-in-law left Nadja after 30 years of marriage. We were stunned. Nadja was devastated. She devoted her life to raising Derek and his brother before pursuing a career of her own. 5 years later, a difficult economy resulted in her losing her job. It became apparent that she couldn't afford to live on her own. With Derek's brother about to leave for the mission field in Australia, Derek and I felt called by God to step in and help support his mom. Besides, it wasn't as if we didn't already get along great. We listed both of our houses for sale, thinking we'd live in whichever one didn't sell. Ours sold first, so we moved in with Nadja. By then, Derek and I had started our family. We had a 2-year-old and a newborn. What had been a perfect place for a couple in their retirement years turned out to be not that kid-friendly at all. There were several flights of stairs, the back deck hung out over a huge drop-off, and the house was on a corner lot at a busy intersection. I worried about our kids not having a safe place to play. Having Nadja around made up for it. She was the opposite of demanding, impossible to please mother-in-law. If anything, she was too sweet and helpful. We hardly had been moved back in a week. She was cooking all our meals, doing our laundry, rushing to take care of things for the kids, and baking them special treats. Of course, they loved being spoiled by their grandmother. I'd assumed that Derek and I would do our own thing when it came to parenting, that Nadja would respect any rules we had, because she had always been so agreeable. After a few months of her constant doting, I got concerned. "Derek, should I say something to your mother?" I asked. "You know I love her, and the kids adore her, but she needs to let us run our own family." "I think she needs to feel needed since my dad left," he said. "She means well, but if you feel like she's doing too much, just talk to her." One day, our oldest had a nightmare and was fussing about going to sleep in his own room. He ran right to Oma. "Come here, sweetheart," she said, swaddling him in a big hug. "Let's get you a snack." "No snacks after bedtime," I said, plucking him from her and walking him back to his room. "How else will he learn to soothe himself and sleep on his own?" "Of course, Mary, you're right," Nadja said. "But once a mother, always a mother." "I really appreciate everything you're doing for us," I said, "but I'm happy to cook for the kids and do our laundry. And most of all, I want them to know that what Derek and I say goes. Not that what we say goes. Until then, talk to Oma." She laughed. "I didn't realize how easily I can spoil them," she said. "It's okay," I said, giving her a hug. 2 years later, when I was pregnant with our third child, we found a new house, a family-friendly ranch on an acre in the Sierra foothills, where the kids could play outside and run around. It was close to schools in a huge park. We remodeled it to include a separate apartment for Nadja. While it was being built, she lived in a trailer on the property. "Can we go over to Oma's?" the kids would ask. It felt like a big deal to them to walk across the little sidewalk and tap on the door of the trailer, where Nadja would have a tea party waiting, complete with china cups and English biscuits. When the apartment walls went up, I made sure there was room for a separate washer and dryer. Maybe if we didn't have to share the appliances anymore, Nadja would finally let me take care of my own laundry. "Lord Jesus," I prayed, "please let this be good for us all. Help Nadja understand what I need from her, more like what I don't need." "Oh, this is fabulous," Nadja exclaimed to me when her apartment was finished. "You thought of everything. I'm going to love living here." I was excited for both of us to have a little more personal space. It didn't last long. Every morning, our back door opened and in strode Nadja with a tray loaded with muffins or fresh fruit. She set her tray down at the table, then go to the stove and get right to cooking. Not that she wasn't a phenomenal cook, but she did have to take over my kitchen every single day. Even when my kids said they weren't really hungry, she'd fill their plates with eggs, sausage, and toast. I tried to talk to Nadja about it. "Please don't think I'm not grateful," I said, "but you have your own apartment now, so I just appreciate you knocking before you come over. And you have your own laundry to do. Would you mind leaving my family's laundry to me? It makes me feel good to do that for them." "I'm sorry," she said. "It's forced a habit. I see the laundry and I do it. You know, once a mother, always a mother." Well, that was certainly true because no matter how often I reminded Nadja, she never remembered to knock before coming in. She kept doing our laundry and making breakfast for us. I joked that she must have been afraid we would wither away without her delicious cooking. Now here she was making yet another huge breakfast for the kids. They looked at me and shrugged. "That's just Oma," their expressions all told me. I felt as though I was going to snap. I opened my mouth, ready to give her a piece of my mind. Instead, something came over me and stilled my tongue. I sipped my coffee and watched my mother-in-law cooking eggs the way each of the kids liked them, scrambled, sunny side up, over easy. Lord, why hasn't Nadja learned to respect my family boundaries after all these years? Nadja was still doing what she'd always done, and she was doing it out of the goodness of her heart. I had to believe. If she hadn't changed, maybe it was because God didn't want her to. He'd made her this way for a reason, and who was I to change what God had made? Maybe what needed changing was my perspective. The next morning at breakfast time, Nadja breezed into the kitchen as usual. I didn't remind her to knock. Instead, I had her sit down with me for a cup of coffee. And I mustered the nerve to ask the question that had been gnawing at me for more than 15 years. "What's the real reason you won't let me do our laundry or teach the kids to make their own breakfast?" I asked. "Is it because you don't think I can do a good enough job for your son and your grandchildren?" "Of course not, Mary. You're a wonderful wife and mother," she said. "You're so busy working and raising the kids, I feel that if I can do anything to make your life easier, then I should. I wish I'd had help with Derek and his brother when they were kids. I should have known Nadja was doing everything out of love. From day one, she opened her arms and her heart to me. It doesn't bother me anymore that loving her back means opening my door to her. These days, I don't even expect her to knock." Building stronger families. Stronger together. 5 tips for multi-generational living. The D'Amour family is part of a growing trend. More than 57 million Americans live in multi-generational households, according to the Pew Research Center. With several age groups under one roof, there are bound to be strains. There are also ways to make multi-generational living a positive experience. Home Instead Senior Care worked with a team of experts to develop these tips. Communication is key. Before combining households, discuss everything from chores to bills to privacy. What are your concerns about? What are you looking forward to? Each family member should give their input. Be money wise. Does moving in together make sense financially? Home Instead Senior Care and Adrian Berg, author of 13 books on personal finance, created a calculator to help families make an informed decision. Go to caregiverstress.com/moneywise to use this tool. Share expenses like roommates if the senior is of sound mind and can afford to contribute. Write 2 checks to the mortgage company, for instance, or alternate paying the mortgage each month, Berg suggests. Make the home safe for all ages. Dan Baldwin, founder of the Certified Aging in Place Specialist Program for the National Association of Home Builders, recommends these affordable measures. Replace doorknobs with lever handles. Switch to low-pile carpet, easier to clean and safer for walkers and wheelchairs. Install grab bars in the shower and tub. Set expectations and boundaries, advises Penn State's Matthew Kaplan, PhD, an expert on intergenerational programs. Responsibilities should be clear. Put them in writing, if needed, so everyone understands how they fit into the household. Think of boundaries not as rigid rules, but as loving limits. Meet regularly to make sure things are still working. Be honest and don't let resentment build up. Address issues when they arise, Kaplan says. Ask yourself, what can we do to come together and figure things out? Get yourself the help you need. Ask adult siblings to chip in. If you're considering professional respite care, contact Home Instead Senior Care at 866-996-1085 or homeinstead.com/guideposts for a free consultation. The IRS's Tax Counseling for the Elderly program offers free tax help. For legal advice, try the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. Attorney locator at naela.org. For more tips on multigenerational living, search intergenerational at caregiverstress.com. What prayer can do. Power in our day-to-day lives. Finding the Master Key by Suni Jeffers, Newport, Washington. You have to be out by the end of the month. It was the woman who owned the store next to our locksmithing business who gave us the bad news. My husband and I had already bought a larger space across the street, but we couldn't move in until we'd finished the renovation we were doing there. In the meantime, we'd arranged to lease our current place month to month until our landlord leased it to our neighbor instead. "We've got nowhere to go," I said to my husband Jim after she left. "We can't afford to shut down while we wait to move into the new place. We'll go out of business." "We have to find some way," he said, "but I couldn't see a way. Lord, if you could lend us a hand here, we'll do our best to make do." Jim and I put our minds to the problem. First, there were the services we provided, like cutting keys. We had a few vans with machines for when we did jobs outside the store. We parked one in front of our new location and ran an extension cord inside. But what about our retail business? We sold locks, safes, master keys, security bars. Those certainly wouldn't fit inside a van, and customers wouldn't be safe inside the new store until construction was complete and we got a certificate from the city. Jim and I moved our stock into the new building, and when a customer made a request of the van, one of us would run inside the store and retrieve the item. Not very efficient, but great exercise. Jim and I could deal with the inconvenience, but could our customers? We had to be prepared for a cut in profits. We just need enough business to cover our employees' salaries and our bills, I reminded God each evening when we packed up. That's all we're asking. In a month, the new space was finally completed. I sat down to do the books. I added the numbers up, then added again. I just couldn't believe the results. Not only had we made enough to cover our bills, it was the best month we'd ever had. For more on this story, see Family Room. Need prayer? Visit ourprayer.org or write to Guide Post Prayer Fellowship, P.O. Box 5813, Harlan, Iowa, 51593-1313. To become a prayer volunteer, visit ourprayervolunteer.org or call 800-935-0158. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.